This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you hear about teenagers shooting other teenagers or holding up stores at gunpoint, you may ask yourself, what leads a young person to do that? We're going to hear what led one young person to do that. My guest, Nathan McCall, served 3 years for armed robbery. While he was in prison, he discovered books and writing. He wrote the head of Norfolk State University's journalism department and told him he badly wanted to make a new start. McCall was accepted to the school and studied journalism after he was paroled. He now writes for the Washington Post and has written a new memoir called Makes Me Wanna Holler. Nathan McCall grew up in a black working-class suburb in Virginia. In the opening chapter of his book, he describes how he and his friends once beat up a white teenager who made the mistake of bicycling through the neighborhood. I asked McCall why they decided to attack him.
It was the kind of thing we didn't even have to decide. It was almost extinct, you know, it was instinct. The sense of hatred was there. And so this white guy became available, accessible. And so we automatically took off after him. We were just sort of programmed for it at that point.
So what were you thinking when you were kicking him?
I can't tell you exactly what I was thinking, but... you know, it was a release. I know at that point I felt that I hated white people and my buddies felt the same. And so, you know, it was not a lot to think about.
Do you think that the hatred that you had for white people that he kind of symbolized at that moment, was it kind of abstraction of white people, or was it about specific white people? Did you know a lot of white people? Was it the larger historical issues, or something more personal?
It was an abstraction.
Uh-huh.
You know, we knew that. Well, I knew I was angry, and but if you ask me specifically who I was angry at, the best that I could tell you was that I was angry at white people. You know, I had this sense that my life and the lives of my parents and the lives of all the other black people I knew were controlled and oppressed by white people who controlled these amorphous institutions. And it was seldom were they accessible to us. And so whenever one became accessible, we took the opportunity to take out our anger on him.
Now you're not from the kind of family where it was inevitable that you were going to turn to guns and crime, or the kind of neighborhood where that was inevitable. I mean, your father was a career military man. You lived in a decent home. When you were young, you were into spelling bees and the honor roll. And from your book, it sounds like you started to change at about when you were age 12. What happened?
My stepfather, he was a hardworking man. He worked at the local naval shipyard, and he also kept a part-time job. He always kept a part-time job to earn extra money. We lived in a working-class neighborhood. My stepfather, on weekends would take my brothers and I across town to this affluent white neighborhood to work in white people's gardens. And that was his part-time hustle. And I was about 13 then. And the civil rights movement was beginning to lose momentum. And the black power movement was picking up steam. And we were hearing, you know, there was this new black pride and this defiance against white people. And some of that had filtered down to me. And so when we would go out to this white neighborhood and work in these people's gardens, I resented it. And I began to resent my stepfather for taking us. And I hated the sight of my stepfather. He was a big guy, still is. Big guy, about 6'2", sort of heavy set, you know, solidly built. The sight of him on his knees working in white people's gardens while they stood over him and supervised just didn't sit well with me, you know? And by that time, I had already had some very traumatic experiences with white people. I had been sent at age 11. I had been sent across town to a mostly white school. And, you know, I encountered the rage of white kids throughout the school. I mean, constantly. They attacked me and taunted me. And as an 11-year-old, I didn't understand it. And my parents weren't very educated, and they didn't have the sophistication to explain to me what I might encounter in this school, the racial hostility. And so as an 11-year-old, I couldn't comprehend that.
Your stepfather tried to discipline you. He tries to impose a curfew. But none of what your parents did was effective. Could they have done anything that would have disciplined you or encouraged you to change your ways and stop stealing things and stop getting into fights?
You know, that's hard to say. That's hard to say. I've often wondered about that. And I thought about it a lot in trying to steer my own son when he came to live with me as a teenager. And, you know, I thought a lot about why I had rejected my stepfather as a role model, because he didn't fit my image of what a man should be. To my way of thinking, a man, a black man, should be someone who could stand up to the white man. And I didn't feel my stepfather did that. The other thing was that while my parents were very good, they came from a generation, that their idea of raising children was that, you know, you made sure that they were fed and clothed and that they had, you know, a decent place to live. And that was about as far as they could take you. You know, they could give you the basic values. Don't, you know, go to school, study. But they couldn't communicate with us very well beyond that. And that's important, I think. It's important for all kids. But it was important to us as black kids trying to figure out our place in this society. We needed someone who could communicate with us about what we were going through and what we would be going through, that sort of thing. I tried that with my son. You know, I tried to create an atmosphere where we could talk about anything, where we could listen to his rap tapes and debate whether, you know, I remember once he came to me late one night and asked me if it was okay to take it from a girl if you took her out on a date and she wouldn't give it up. And I was tired and about to go to bed. And when he asked that question, I knew it was going to be a long evening. And we must have sat up until about 3 o'clock in the morning just talking about women and their perception of women, my perception of women when I was his age.
I find your book really fascinating because there's so many things that I think those of us who haven't lived the kind of life you have find it really difficult to understand. Why would somebody do that? How can somebody do that? Mm-hmm. And you try so hard to explain, you know, what was going through your mind during certain periods of your life and when you got yourself into certain jams. And I think it's just really fascinating to read and to hear you talk about it. So I want to move on to another incident in your life that I think was a real kind of pivotal point for you, very dramatic. Someone had insulted your girlfriend, and this was the girl who was your son's mother. And you felt that the right response was to shoot this guy. What did he do that you thought merited that strong a response?
Well, I mean, that goes back to the issue of respect. You know, we had some very clear ideas about what constituted disrespect.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things was that you did not allow anyone to disrespect your girlfriend. I read stories occasionally nowadays where guys get shot over disrespecting somebody's girlfriend. It was part of the street code. And so this guy, he offended my girlfriend. He called her a name, and she shot him a bird. And she told me about it, and we saw him at a carnival a short time after that. And we had the baby with us, and we were pushing the stroller, and this guy and some of his buddies approached us. And the guy, we called him Plaz. He was an older guy, and he approached us and said something else to my girlfriend. And so at that point, I decided I had to shoot him. You know, he had broken all the rules, and there was no way, to my way of thinking, mm-hmm. as a teenager, there was no way that I could let him get away with that and hold my head up. And so I had a gun on me, and he kept talking and got louder and louder. And so I pulled the gun and shot him.
Where'd you shoot him?
I shot him in the chest. We were we were standing about 3 feet apart, and I just pulled the gun and fired all in one motion.
What did it feel like to pull the trigger?
You know, it was a bizarre feeling. This guy fell to the ground as soon as I shot him, and it felt good. You know, and I don't know how that sounds, but it felt good enough for me to want to do it again. And so I walked toward him, and I was about to point the pistol at him and shoot him again. And a friend of mine who happened to be out there called my name and said, "No, Nate, you don't want to do that." And he ran up behind me and grabbed the gun from my hand. And so that gave Plaz enough time to gather himself. And he was holding his chest. He jumped up and ran into the parking lot and collapsed between some cars.
How did it feel to look at his face when you looked him in the eye?
Well, I mean, you know, I saw something that I hadn't seen before. This guy was an old head. He was like a very intimidating hood. And I had always been a little afraid of him. But after I shot him, I saw this look of horror on his face.
And that made you feel powerful?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. Guns, I think, you know, guns in the hands of young people make them feel powerful. You know, having a gun was a serious power trip for me.
My guest is Nathan McCall. He's a reporter at the Washington Post and the author of a new memoir called Makes Me Wanna Holler, A Young Black Man in America. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. I'm back with journalist Nathan McCall. He's a writer with the Washington Post and the author of a new memoir called Makes Me Wanna Holler, A Young Black Man in America. Well, this guy you shot, this got you, you pled guilty to a lesser charge. You got 30 days, a $300 fine, and 1 year probation. A little later, you held up a McDonald's with some friends. You were the gunman. You got sentenced to 12 years. You served 3 of them, and then you were paroled. And life in prison really turned you around. You started reading. You started getting a discipline. You started working at various jobs in the hopes of maintaining some kind of discipline. What do you think it was that changed you? Did it have something to do with the solitude, the structure, getting away from your friends?
You know, that may have been a small part of it. But it certainly wasn't the prison itself. The prison environment is in no way conducive to a positive transformation. It's just not. But I was fortunate enough to run across some old heads who had been through the system several times and had gotten a fair amount of wisdom that they were willing to impart to some of the young bloods. And they would, you know, sit down and rap to me about life and about things. And I wrote about this guy who taught me to play chess, you know, and explained to me the philosophy of chess and talked about the parallels of between chess and life. And he was an inspiration. The thing that impacted me most deeply, though, was a book that I ran across almost randomly. I was in the Norfolk jail waiting to be transferred to prison. And it was overcrowded in the jail and I was miserable. And so I volunteered to push the library cart around on my floor to get out of my jail cell. And so I had, you know, have these books on this cart, and I ran across this book that had the picture of a black man on the cover, and it was Native Son by Richard Wright.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked it up, and I leafed through it, and I couldn't put it down. It was the first book that I had run across that that I could identify with. You know, it was the story of a young black man, Bigger Thomas, who was about the same age I was, 20 years old. And he saw the world as I saw the world. He was confused. He was frustrated. He was, you know, he both hated whites and feared them. And that's how I felt. When I finished, I broke down and cried because this writer had described all my feelings. And, you know, he had described my anger. He had even described the pain that I felt.
So did this start you reading more?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was an amazing discovery for me that, you know, I just didn't think that there were people who wrote about those kinds of things. You know, the regular guy on the street.
Should we interpret this to mean that the prison system really does work? People do get changed for the better.
That would be a tremendous leap of logic. No way. It wasn't the prison system. It was the book. It was the nature of the literature. You know, the way that I interpret it is that, you know, this is something that I should have run across in the school system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but all through my years in school, the things that I learned had seemed irrelevant to me. I didn't see myself in any of those pages, you know, and whether it was English literature or history or, you know, I couldn't look in any of those books and get a sense of my place in the world or, you know, the place of other black people. And that's important to everyone.
So when you got out of prison, you went to Norfolk State University, studied journalism, then you got a job reporting with your hometown paper, the Virginia Pilot Ledger Star.
Yes.
Then you got a job with the Atlanta Constitution. And while you were in Atlanta, you were invited to apply for a job at the Washington Post. Now, when you were at the Post, a lot of what you wrote about was the prison system, reforms in the prison system and controversies in the prison system, programs for prisoners. What was it like for you to cover that as a beat?
Well, I had the first time I went out to the Lorton prison and saw all those black men out there. I thought about the time I had spent in prison and all the black men who were in prison there. And that first day, I went home and I had the worst headache and I just had to lie down because it was so depressing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was often depressing for me to go back there. And you know, often the lines between my professionalism and my sense of personal responsibility got blurred, you know, because I would meet guys, you know, and see in them things that I saw in my old self. And I'd have to, you know, put the notepad aside and just have a brother-to-brother talk with them, you know. And I found myself testifying sometimes rather than covering news.
What's it like for you now that you've written this book and people know about your past, they know about your record? Is that changing the way people see you, colleagues who maybe didn't know that much about you, or maybe people who you're covering now as a journalist?
Well, I'm still on leave of absence.
Uh-huh. So covering hasn't come up
yet. Right, that hasn't come up yet. But initially, when I first, you know, the book stemmed from a piece that I wrote for the Washington Post Outlook section.
Mm-hmm.
And when I decided to write that piece, it was about my life. And about the ambivalence I feel when I go home and see some of my old buddies on the block. When I decided to write that piece, I was scared to death because I had never written anything for public, you know, for publication about my background.
Mm-hmm.
I'd sell, you know, I didn't even talk to people on my job about my background. You know, if they knew it, they found out on their own because I didn't bring it up. And so I was scared that if I wrote this piece and it was published, that there might be a strong negative public reaction. But that didn't happen. When the piece was published, I got a lot of calls and letters from black people who said, you remind me of my uncle who went to prison. Or, you know, they'd say, you know, I've got a cousin who is just coming out of jail, and what do you recommend that I say to him? And surprisingly to me, I also got a lot of calls and letters from whites who said, you know, you helped me understand some things that I've been grappling with but had been unable to understand because I'm so removed from that whole experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they said thank you, and some of them called and invited me out for coffee, and it gave me a warm feeling. It really, you know, it boosted my optimism.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of reinforced for me the sense that people are basically good. You know, if given enough information, people would draw the right conclusions. And there was a time I would have never said that about whites, you know, but because of the response that I got, it reinforced that notion in me.
Nathan McCall, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Nathan McCall is the author of the new memoir, Makes Me Wanna Holler, A Young Black Man in America. He writes for The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.